Okay, all right, we're starting a new Maseches. We'll start from the Mishnah again. You have the illegal Sonsino there.
Illegal?
Well, not illegal, but that's the one that infringed their copyright. Yeah, that's the traditional press. Yeah.
Okay. And it's before he got here. Okay. For sure, before I got here. It's the vice of fire. Oh, look at that. Yeah, it's got a little charm. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, as you know, Maseches Beit, or Beya, we say.
Why do we say Beya, not Beit?
Well, Beya is the Aramaic for Beit, and there are two reasons that they're given. They seem to be strange reasons. One reason is that Beya also means to ask Hashem for mercy. So as a remez, we use the Aramaic, that we always ask Hashem for mercy. The other is that Beita also refers to a male testicle, and therefore it's not called a Lashon Nekiah, so we do it the Aramaic. But again, it's, now, the Mishnah starts off, strangely enough, not with the basic laws of Yom Tov. The basic laws actually come into the middle. In fact, you can actually notice a pattern in the Mishnah, that usually the basic laws of a subject are not at the beginning of a Maseches, they're in the middle of a Maseches, and the beginning of a Maseches often deal with esoterica. Part of that is to stimulate your interest, and part of that is to make sure that you learn the middle, because people often don't get to the middle. So for example, in Maseches Gittin, if you want to know how to write again, you have to learn almost the very end of the Maseches. Okay, and the like. Similarly here, the basic laws of Yom Tov are actually more in the third parak. But this deals with a certain detail, which is primarily concerned with the laws of Muktzah. But actually there are three topics in the Mishnah. The first topic of the Mishnah is, Beya Shenel de Yom Tov. If an egg was laid on Yom Tov, so you want to eat the egg, Be Shamai Omrim Teyochel, Beis Shammai says you are allowed, the egg may be eaten on Yom Tov, even though it was laid on Yom Tov. Beis Hillel Omrim Lo Seyochel, Beis Hillel says it cannot be eaten. By the way, how do you have it in the Kudah? Do you have Seyochel or Tochal? Teyochel. Teyochel, right. So it's the passive. Teyochel means it can be eaten, and Beis Hillel says it cannot be eaten. The basic problem here is that there is a category of muktzah, forbidden objects, that are called nolad, things that are newly created on Shabbos or Yom Tov, are not supposed to be used. An egg that was laid on Shabbos and Yom Tov is a species of nolad. We'll get into this in much more detail. Beis Shammai didn't have a problem with the concept of nolad. Beis Hillel did. And this is an unusual instance where Beis Hillel is stricter than Beis Shammai. However, as is usually the case, we still paskin like Beis Hillel, and we paskin such an egg cannot be eaten. Now, it doesn't mean it can't be eaten forever. It just means it cannot be eaten on Shabbos or Yom Tov. You can eat it after Shabbos and Yom Tov. Now, we will discuss in the Gemara, what about in Chutz La'aretz, where you have 2 days of Yom Tov, or even in Eretz Yisrael, where you have 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. If the egg is born on day one, are you allowed to eat it on day two? We'll talk about that. Or what if it's Yom Tov followed by Shabbos? Or Shabbos followed by Yom Tov? What is the status of the next day? Okay, the Gemara will talk about all of those questions, but right now that's not our question. We're only talking about the actual day that it was laid. So that's Machlokas number one. And we will see exactly what that is based on. Now Machlokas number two is about Chametz on Pesach. Beis Shammai Omrim, Seor Bikazayas, v'chametz bikakosevis. Okay, seor is not yeast. Seor is leavening, leaven. That refers to the sourdough. That if you're into baking, you know. In fact, some of these, I understand, some of these starters are what, like 100 years old or something? I think in some of the, they have like real old things that have been fermenting for
a
century.
They keep it alive. They nourish it again.
Right, but supposedly they're very valuable. They're like they're kind of trade secrets and the like. Now the Torah prohibits two things: you're not allowed to have chametz, and you're not allowed to have seor, which is also chametz, but it's chametz plus. Now the question is, what is the negative commandment here of owning chametz on Pesach? There are two negative commandments. Lo yera'el lecha sa'or, v'lo yimatzeh. You should not have it seen, you should not have it found. Now what Beis Shammai says is, the shi'ur, the quantity of prohibition for sa'or, is less than the quantity of prohibition of regular bread. For sa'or, for that which is a starter that's capable of making other things ferment, the shi'ur for which you transgress, bal yera'eh, has to be at least a kezayis, the size of an olive. Less than that, there's no prohibition. I'll talk about that in a moment. But regular chametz is regular bread. It's not a starter. The shear has to be a bigger shear, and that's a koseves. A koseves is a dried date. And although you wouldn't necessarily know this, but Chazal tell us that the date is considered to be approximately 1.5 hours. And therefore, koseves is a larger shear. Now, Beis Hillel says, Zev Zev Bekazayas. Chametz and Sa'or are identical. Sa'or is nothing more than a certain type of chametz, and therefore the shear is identical. And we, of course, paskin like Beis Hillel. Now, Robert, you asked a question last week, and it is a good question. Wait a second here. Let's just look at Beis Hillel. Forget about Beis Shammai. Beis Hillel says, whether it's chametz or sa'or, the shear is not a koseves, the shear is a kezayis. Meaning, I transgress bal yera'eh u'bal yimatzeh only if I have chametz in my house that is at least the volume of a kezayis. What does that mean? So why on earth do I have to clean my house for Pesach? I mean, here's the thing. People are looking for tiny little crumbs. What's the problem? I mean, if the Mishnah is telling me that I'm allowed to have chametz in my house if it's less than a kezayis, then all I should be looking for are big, obvious pieces of chametz. And if there's no big, obvious pieces of chametz, what do I have to worry about? Right? That's a very good question. The Mishnah says that the shear of bal yera'eh, bal yimatzeh, even like Beis Hillel, is a kezayis. And even Beis Shammai, well, Beis Shammai is even more lenient, but he says koseves, right? Okay. So the short answer actually is, there are two answers to give. First of all, one answer is that the kezayis under these circumstances is accumulative, meaning to say it doesn't mean a kezayis in one ball. Rather, if I have 5 crumbs here, and 5 crumbs here, and 10 crumbs here, and 20 crumbs there, if the sach hakol, it adds up to a kezayis, I'm over in Bal Yera'eh. So since, you know, you never know really what your crumbs are going to add up to, so we go out and we look for all of those crumbs. But the other answer is, which is maybe the simplest answer, is rabbinically, you indeed have to get rid of all of your chametz, either by selling it. I mean, again, it doesn't have to be by destroying it. You can sell your chametz too, but you have to get rid of it. So it is true that the Isser d'Oraisa of owning chametz requires that it be at least a kezayis, but rabbinically you do have to get rid of even less than a kezayis.
Where does it say that it's a kezayis?
Where does it say it?
Yeah.
In the Torah, you mean?
Yeah. No.
It is a good question, but the reason is because the prohibition of ownership of chametz is compared to the prohibition of eating chametz. And the prohibition of eating chametz, all eating prohibitions always require a kezayis before you can get punished and the like. Which actually means min haTorah, you don't transgress the issur of eating chametz unless you eat a kezayis of chametz. Yeah. Okay. All right, so that's the second machlokas. And again, the Gemara will go into each of these. We then come to the third machlokas, which is a bit complicated. Hashochet Chaya v'yof v'yomtov. A person wants to slaughter a chaya. Chaya is a non-domesticated animal, like a kosher deer. You can get in some places, in restaurants in New York, Levana, you can get venison and the like. It's kosher meat and the like. You're allowed to first of all, let's take the obvious. You are allowed to shecht on yomtov. That's the obvious point. Why are you allowed to shecht? Because you're allowed to do any malacha for food preparation, so shechita is permissible. That's fine. Now, the halacha is that when you shecht a chaya or an oaf, a bird, a chicken, there is a mitzvah called kisui hadam. The blood that spurts out of the animal must be covered with either dirt or typically sawdust. It must be covered with some granulated substance. That's a mitzvah called kisui hadam. Now remember, the mitzvah of kisui hadam only applies to shechting a chaya, an oaf. It does not apply to shechting a behemah. So when cattle, when sheep, goats, or cows are slaughtered, there is no mitzvah of kisui hadam. Kisui hadam is only for chaya v'yof.
What about a giraffe?
A giraffe is a chaya, yeah. Assuming you can shecht a giraffe. A giraffe is in fact a kosher animal, and people often say, well, you can't shecht a giraffe because we can't locate the area of the shechita, but that's not true. You can certainly locate the area of the shechita. You have a big area. it's actually easier. That's right. But yeah, there's a fellow, the Sigmund Sanoma, Ari Zavatovsky, who's he's a Muslim and a scientist in Eretz Israel. But his hobby is he goes into all of the halachos of exotic animals and everything else. So he actually arranged a banquet in Israel, and he invited a lot of rabbis, and they had it in New York too. They produced a 60-page source book of halachas, kind of, they didn't have giraffe, but they had, you know, exotic animals, exotic birds, different types of grasshoppers, right, right, because there are kosher grasshoppers, and the Yemenites have a tradition as to what is a kosher grasshopper, so they had those things, right, all of those different things. And, he did advise people, do not come without talking to your rabbi first in terms of whether you're allowed to eat any of the stuff.
Concept,
yeah.
They
are, yeah. The
most recent edition of what it's like, considering what it's about, a giraffe. It's not necessarily, it's not a nice long doctor's question.
Yeah.
Do you require tradition?
Right. That's a big issue, because it does say by birds, no bird can be eaten, even if it seems to be a kosher bird, unless there's a tradition that bird was regarded as kosher. That even created problems about turkeys, because turkeys were native North American and they were not known in Europe. And the question then becomes, is it close enough to a chicken that you can include it in the Masorah? Now, that is said by birds. The question becomes whether that would also be true by other animals, because there's a very logical reason why birds are different than other animals, because the Torah does not actually tell us what defines a kosher bird. The Torah just gives us a list of non-kosher birds. It does not really tell us. So consequently, you know, you need a Masorah. On the other hand, when the Torah tells you beferish that split hoofs and chewing cud is kosher, so what do you need a Masorah for? I mean, you actually have the sign. So it would actually appear logical that there is no need for a tradition for kosher animals, and yet some poskim have required the Masorah. Okay. So anyway, the issue that the Mishnah is facing is the following. I'm allowed to shecht on Yom Tov, no problem. But I have a problem in fulfilling the mitzvah of kisui hadam. And the reason that is so is that there are a number of issues that could arise. First issue is, if I got to dig into the ground to get my dirt, assuming I didn't have prepared sawdust, digging into the ground is in itself a malacha. Now, what malacha is involved in digging? So really, it's two different things. Making the hole, is a malacha called choresh. You're plowing. Because plowing is making a furrow in soil. So even though it doesn't look like plowing, but since plowing is an activity that makes a furrow in the ground, so any digging of a hole is considered to be plowing. Now, second of all, taking the shovel and crushing the dirt to pulverize it is another malacha, and that's a malacha called tochen. Tochen is grinding. So, there are two malachos that are involved in kisui hadam. One is choresh, making the hole, and the other is tochen, grinding. Now, there is a third problem in kisui hadam, which is a rabbinic problem, and that is dirt and sand are normally considered to be worthless entities, and because of that, they are muktzah. You're not allowed to move them or handle them. So I have the problem of choresh, I have the problem of tochein, and I have the problem of muktzah. Now, how do I get around it? Now, first of all, you might be thinking the following. Wait a second here. Why is there a problem of choresh? I mean, think about this. Shechita is a malacha, but you're allowed to shecht because it's Yom Tov, so let me dig a hole because it's Yom Tov. The answer is there's a very big difference. Right, you're only allowed to do the activities that are directly relevant to the preparation of the food. So I could kill the animal. But this, and let me give you an example. If, for example, let's assume I don't have a pot to cook my food on Yom Tov. Am I allowed to make a pot? No, because that's not connected to the making of the food. Same thing here. The digging the hole to cover, to get the dirt, to cover the blood, that's not directly connected to the food preparation. So our three problems are choresh, tochein, and muktzah. So how do you get around that? So Beis Shammai, at first glance, seems to say no problem, but the Gemara will qualify this. Beis Shammai Omrim. Yachbor bedeker, you can dig in with your shovel. Deker is a shovel. Vayechase, and cover. Now, if you read this literally, that's why I'm going ahead a little bit, telling you what the Gemara says, because Rashi himself brings it. If you were to read this sentence without the Gemara, you would basically conclude, Beis Shammai has no problem at all. No problem of choresh, no problem of tochein, no problem of muktzah. He just says, go ahead and dig a hole. Mm-hmm. But it's not that simple. The Gemara actually explains that Beis Shammai permits this. Beis Shammai permits this only where. So where did Rashi say? One second, son. Let me hold off on that because actually I was looking at what Rashi said about Beis Shammai. Okay, so let's learn Beis Shammai Kipshuto at this point. That Beis Shammai doesn't have a problem. We'll see why or whether that's fully true. Beis Hillel Omrim. Beis Hillel says there is a problem. Beis Hillel basically says lo yishchot. You shouldn't even shecht because you won't be able to do kisoy. So if you're not going to be able to do kisoy yadam, don't shecht. Ela im kein. Haya lo afar muchan mibod yom. You should not shecht unless you have prepared dirt before Yom Tov for the purpose of kisui hadan. Now, how would you prepare it? This would mean the following. You must have dug your hole before Yom Tov. You must have pulverized your dirt. And you must have set it aside with the intention that you're going to use it on Yom Tov. Now, keep in mind, this negates all three problems. You're not plowing because you've already made your hole. You're not grinding because you already ground it. And it's not considered muktzah because anything that you designated, even stones or sticks, that you're going to use before Shabbos is not muktzah. So Beis Hillel basically says, unless you did all of this before Yom Tov, you are not even allowed to shecht. The logic of this is because since if you shecht, you will not be able to do kisui. So the only thing we can tell you is don't shecht. Now, of course, it doesn't mean don't shecht the behemah. Behemah you can shecht because there's no kisui, but you're not allowed to shecht a chaya v'yof unless you made all of the preparations for kisui beforehand. That's what Beis Hillel says. So again, Beis Hillel is strict. Beis Shammai is megel. But then the Gemara says, Umodim. But Beis Hillel is moda. She'im shachat. Let's say you went ahead and you shechted, which you shouldn't have done. So what do you do now? She'yachbor v'deker v'yachase. So what's strange here is the following. Again, we'll learn the Mishnah literally at this point, then we'll see what it means. It seems to be the following. After the fact, once you shecht, even Beis Hillel says, dig in. And of course we'll have the problem, why are you allowed to do that? But he says, v'chatchila, you shouldn't shecht unless you prepared everything. So So the machlokes Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is, Beis Shammai says you can shech the chatchila on that basis. Beis Hillel says you cannot shech the chatchila on that basis. If you did shech, then you can dig in, crush the dirt, and sprinkle it. But again, the Gemara is going to give us some radically different interpretations. Now, the next sentence, she'efer, grammatically is a non sequitur. She'efer, she is because. This seems to be giving a reason why I'm allowed to make a hole in the ground, because it says, because the ashes of an oven are considered to be prepared for this. Now that sentence makes no sense. I'm allowed to dig in the ground and crush the dirt because the ashes in the oven are designated for this purpose. That makes no sense. So what the Gemara says, and Rashi brings this as well, is you put a vav here, and Beis Hillel is actually giving you two pieces of advice. One is im shachat sheyachbor bedeker v'yechaseh the she'efer ki remuchanu, which means the following. If you shechted, in lieu of digging a hole in the ground, you can take ashes from your oven and use that for kisui hadam. And that is preferable, because taking ashes from your oven does not involve digging holes, and it does not involve grinding. It is still muktzah, that's correct. But the simple meaning of this would be that it would be preferable just to have a muktzah problem without a malacha problem, rather than digging a hole where you have muktzah and malacha at the same time. Yeah, actually, that's the point. The point of the Mishnah is that it's not muktzah, that the ashes in the oven are considered to be set aside for those types of purposes, and therefore they're not muktzah. So according to this, the Mishnah is giving you two halachas. If you shechted, you can either dig a hole if you must, or, best of all, use the afer of a kira. Afer is different than upright. Afar is dirt. Afer is ashes. Different word. You can use the ashes of an oven because that's called mukhan. That is called prepared or set aside for that. That's right. That even without that specific, right, there's a general presumption that people look to use ashes for these types of purposes.
So you could use the ashes even if you had dirt.
Yeah, that's correct. Meaning to say that the last sentence is not limited to im shachat, but it even says, but even the chatchila you could shech under those circumstances. Okay? But again, we're going to discuss, the Gemara will discuss each of these machlokes. So we have three machlokesim in the Mishnah. One about the egg that is laid on Yom Tov. The other is, what is the shear of Bal Yeroya, Bal Yematzai for Chametz? And the third is, are you allowed to shecht if you don't have Efer Kira and you didn't prepare your dirt from beforehand? Are you allowed to shecht a Chaya V'Yov on Yom Tov? In all three of these cases, Beis Shammai is lenient, Beis Hillel is machmir. Again, that's a bit unusual, but in all three of these cases, we do paskin like Beis Hillel, which means, this is an important lesson actually, don't think that we pass him like Beis Hillel because he's always easy. It's not because he's easy, it's because he's Beis Hillel. So whether he's easy or strict, we pass him like Beis Hillel. Okay. Alright, so the first issue is the ratio of the Mishnah. The egg that is born on Yom Tov, Beis Shammai says you can eat, Beis Hillel says you cannot eat. So the Gemara asks the question, B'mayas kinan. What type of chicken are we talking about? Right, there are two types of chickens. There's a hen that is set aside to lay eggs, and there's a hen that you're planning on slaughtering. In other words, it happens to lay an egg, but you're holding it for meat. Now, ilema, if you're going to say tarnagoles ha'omedes li'achila, that the hen was set aside to be eaten, my tamayu de Beis Hillel. Uchla diifrasa. Okay, here's the thing. If you have a chicken that you intend to shecht, meaning you're holding it for meat, then the chicken is not muktzah because you're planning on shechting it. The egg shouldn't be muktzah either Because the egg is simply part of the chicken that came out. Meaning, instead of looking at the egg as a newly created separate thing, I mean, imagine, of course, we shall have treif in those situations, but if a piece of the chicken fell off, I mean, you wouldn't be able to eat it for other reasons. But technically, if the chicken is not muktza because it's an object of food, then the egg which separates from the chicken should simply be a piece of food that came off. Right? You never say, for example, if you have a fruit and a piece of fruit falls off the fruit, or a grape falls off a cluster on Yom Kippur. I don't mean a cluster on a tree, I mean a cluster in a bowl. You're not going to say, oh, this is a newly created entity that's muktza because it was on the cluster beforehand. You say, well, the grapes are not muktza. So the grape is not muktza, it is simply food that's separated from food. So the Gemara's kasha is, if the chicken was set aside to be ochel, and the egg is ochel, this is simply ochel that's separated from ochel. It should not be muktza at all, because it is not a newly created entity, it is simply part of the chicken. Now, granted, an egg is part of, it's true, it's not really part of the chicken in the sense of being meat, but it's part of the chicken in the sense of being a food product. So the question becomes, a tarnagolas almedes liachila, my taimayu de Beis Hillel, why does Beis Hillel say it's forbidden to eat the egg? Uchla di ifras hu, it is an ochel, ifras, that became separated from another ochel. Ella, so let's take the other alternative, tarnagolas haomedes legadel beyim. It is a chicken, a hen, that is set aside to lay eggs. It is not set aside for food. So here the Gemara says, "My taimayu de Beis Shammai mukti." So again, let's think about this. The question itself is worthy of some thought. If it's a tarnagolas set aside for food, the problem is, why does Beis Hillel forbid it? But if it's a tarnagolas that's set aside for laying eggs, we understand Beis Hillel, but we don't understand is Beis Shammai. Now let's think about that. Why do we understand Beis Hillel? Meaning to say, the Gemara apparently is saying at this point, if it's a chicken that is set aside for laying eggs, then for sure the egg should be muktza. The reason is because that makes it a nolad. Why is that so? The chicken is not a food, because the chicken was set aside to lay eggs. The chicken was not an ochel. Now that it's laid an egg, the egg is a new entity, because the egg, not only is it new in the physical sense, that it's just come into the world, but it's new in the functional sense, that it has acquired a purpose and a use that is different than the use from which it came. It came from a chicken whose purpose was laying eggs. Now, right, an egg cannot lay an egg, now it's only good for food. So that makes it a newly created entity, because it has a function that is disassociated from where it came. And that's called muktza. Muktza means an object. Well, there are many types of muktza, but muktza literally means set aside. And that means something that was not in a state of ready use when Shabbos began. A newly created entity was not in a state of usefulness when Shabbos began. And therefore the Gemara says, we understand Beis Hillel, but we don't understand Beis Shammai. So the Gemara's kasha is in the nature of a mimanafshach. Manafshach means either way you look at it, you got a problem. If it's an egg-laying chicken, we know why it's muktza, but we don't understand Beis Shammai. If it's a chicken that's being raised for slaughter, we understand Beis Shammai, we don't understand Beis Hillel. So what is the case going to be where you have a machlokes, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, where both sides make sense? So the Gemara parenthetically asks a question on its question. Because we just said, that if it's a chicken that is there for eggs, why does Beis Shammai say it's permitted? It ought to be muktza. Now, that question presupposes something. That question is making the assumption that Beis Shammai subscribes to the concept of Muktzah. And the Gemara says, how do you know that he does? Umay Kusha, what is your question? Dilma Beis Shammai, Leslahu Muktzah. Maybe Beis Shammai does not have a concept of Muktzah. So let me explain a little of this outside, because I understand all this. There actually is a machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon regarding many types of objects that we call muktzah, where Rabbi Yehuda says they're forbidden to be handled because they're muktzah, and Rabbi Shimon actually does not have the law of muktzah. Now the example that's given, here Rashi gives us some examples here. If you look in the Rashi, Letzlehu muktzah, that Beis Shammai may not hold of muktzah, the Dilma, perhaps, to Rabbi Shimon Sfiralehu, that Beis Shammai might hold like Rabbi Shimon. What does Rabbi Shimon say? The Amar Beperek Kira. Rabbi Shimon says in the chapter Kira, that's the third chapter of Masechet Shabbos, Mosar, not Mutcher, Mosar Hashemen Shebener Veshebekaara Aser, Divrei Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon Matcher. Okay, the particular case is the following. You lit a candle before Shabbos, an oil candle. The candle goes out before the oil has been burnt up. Can I use the surplus oil in a candle that has become extinguished on Shabbos? Rabbi Yehuda says, I cannot. Rabbi Shimon says, I can. Now, what does that have to do with muktzah? Again, by the way, I mean, if you're confused, I mean, there's good reason. I mean, even the definition of muktzah is one of the most confusing sugyas and shas. So, this is very, very complex to get a definition here. But we would say that the oil is muktzah. Why is the oil muktzah? Because here is the thing. When Shabbos began, this oil was in a burning candle. The oil was inaccessible. It was not in a state of usability. Muktzah means anything that is not in a state of usability when Shabbos begins cannot be handled on Shabbos, even if it later becomes usable. Let's go through a bunch of examples. So, the oil in a candle that was extinguished was not usable when Shabbos began, because it was in a candle, burning candle. Right? So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says, even after the oil burns out, or even after the candle burns out, it's muktzah. Let's take other examples of muktzah. Pencils and pens are muktzah. Why are pencils and pens muktzah? Because since their use commonly involves forbidden activity, they're not in a state of permissible use. Therefore, they can't be moved. Okay, that's what muktzah. Okay, so the key of muktzah is, you ask the following question. When, of course, a pen is muktzah, in other words, a pen is not the same shiloh, because a pen is not an example of something, you know, that was not usable, that became usable. The pen continues to be not usable. But the key question you ask by muktzah is, when Shabbos began, was this object in a state of permissible use on Shabbos?
Other than what it is.
Permissible use.
Other than,
what do you mean, other than
lighting the candle?
Well, a candle is not, yeah, well, that's right, but that's not called use because, I mean, it's burning, in other words, but in terms of using it for something else. Now, here is the thing. If it is in a state of permissible use, that is what we mean by the word mukhan. Mukhan means it is treated as designated. Designation doesn't mean you specifically have to. In other words, I don't have to say, I am designating this chumash to read on Shabbos. Because since the use of a chumash is a permissible use, so books are not muktzah. Are secular books muktzah? Actually, some opinions say yes, meaning if you follow the view If you follow the view that you're not allowed to read a secular book on Shabbos, then a secular book would be muktzah. If you follow the view you're allowed to read a secular book on Shabbos, it's not muktzah. In other words, muktzah follows the permissibility of use. In other words, what I'm saying is, before you determine if something is muktzah, you first have to determine whether it was in a state where it could be permissibly used when Shabbos began. So, electrical appliances are muktzah, pens, pencil, blank writing paper. I'll get to it. There's nothing. Blank writing paper is considered to be muktzah, etc., because it is not in a state of its normal permissible use. The oil in a burning candle is muktzah, even when the candle goes out, right? Because it was not in a state of readiness. Now,
how does the kavana get that if you have the intent of using it? Like,
okay, so the kavana says the following: even if something's normal use is not a permissible Shabbos use, but if you specifically had intention that you're going to use it anyway, you can make your own pre-Shabbos designation, and that will take off the din of muktzah. But you don't need to have that if the normal use is permissible. You don't need to set aside a chumash to be able to read a chumash. You don't need to set aside silverware to be able to use it on Shabbos. On the other hand, if you want to use, let's say, a hammer for a fork or whatever it would be, you know, you would have to have hachana, because the normal use of a hammer is to, you know, drive nails in or whatever. Now, so one way something can become muktzah is if its use was an impermissible Shabbos use, and therefore it was muktzah. Another way it could be muktzah is if intrinsically it normally has no use. Rocks, dirt, sand is muktzah, because it generally has no use unless you designated the rock to be a paperweight before Shabbos, like a pet rock. Okay, so this is so there are many, many different types of muktzah, but the common denominator of muktzah is when Shabbos began, it was not in a state where the object is treated as a usable Shabbos object. Objects which are normally usable are not muktzah. Objects which are not normally usable are muktzah unless they were pre-designated for Shabbos use. Now, having said that, once something is in a state of muktzah, there are two consequences. Consequence number one is you're not allowed to use it. I can't use this oil. Consequence number two is I'm not allowed to move it. Right, so the issue about a pen, the issue is not can I write with the pen. Of course I can't do that. I can't even move it. Muktzah is an isser to use, and muktzah is an isser to move. Now let me emphasize, muktzah is not an isser to touch. You are allowed to touch muktzah things, but you cannot move muktzah things. The rabbis forbade muktzah in tiltzel. Yeah. Now, the point I want to make is the case of the oil, the candle that went out. Can I use that extra oil? Rabbi Yehuda says I cannot, because when Shabbos began it was not usable. But Rabbi Shimon permits it. Now, Rabbi Shimon never gives us a general rule here, but the Gemara is assuming that for some reason Rabbi Shimon does not have a problem with muktzah. Even if something was not in a state of readiness, it's permitted if it becomes useful later. So the Gemara is saying, well, gee, that might be the answer to our Mishnah. Once we've identified one opinion who has no problem with muktzah, of course that might also explain Beis Shammai at the end of the Mishnah too, but we're not going there yet. That might explain why you could dig a hole, etc. But putting that aside, once we've identified one opinion that doesn't have a problem with muktzah, so maybe Beis Shammai is that opinion. So it's very good. The Mishnah is talking about a chicken that was set aside for laying eggs. the egg that is laid was muktzah because it's a newly created entity, but Beis Shammai has no problem because Beis Shammai holds like Rabbi Shimon that there's no problem of muktzah. So the Gemara says why we're not making that assumption. Because this is a stricter form of muktzah called nolad, meaning to say the following. There might be three reasons. In other words, again, what's muktzah? When Shabbos began, it was not a usable object. There might be three reasons why that might be so. Number one, because its use involves a prohibition, like extinguishing a candle. Number two, because it's a worthless object, like rocks or dirt. Or number three, it was a non-existent object. In other words, obviously, that which was non-existent when Shabbos began was not in a state of usefulness. So here's what the Gemara is saying. Maybe that third category of muktzah is so strict that even Rabbi Shimon would agree with it. Granted, Rabbi Shimon does say objects which were physically in existence, which were not usable, like a burning candle, are not muktzah. But that doesn't mean he would defend the laid egg, which is a newly created object. And therefore, in other words, the Gemara is explaining its question. Therefore, we really don't understand Beis Shammai. Why would Beis Shammai permit it? What are you going to answer? He follows Rabbi Shimon? Maybe Rabbi Shimon does not subscribe to normal muktzah, but the muktzah of nolad, even Rabbi Shimon would subscribe to. Yeah.
What about a newborn baby that was born on Shabbat? Is
that under the normal rules of muktzah, yes, indeed, the newborn baby would be muktzah. That's true. The newborn baby is not worse than an egg, obviously, but because of pikuach nefesh. You're allowed to hold a baby and take care of a baby. We're not going to say you can't touch the baby for till after Shabbos. Yeah. Okay, but that's the Gemara's point. In other words, kosal kadaitin, we think, we're explaining our thinking here, afilu man deshari mukta, even the opinion who permits mukta objects, that's Rabbi Shimon, the nolad for a newly created object, usher. And if that's so, we're back to our question: my taimayu debase shamay. So Rav Nachman gives the simplest answer of all. He says the correlation or the assumption you made that nolad is worse than muktzah just is not true. Meaning to say, if Rabbi Shimon permits muktzah, Rabbi Shimon permits nolad. Beis Shammai goes like Rabbi Shimon, and that's why a newly created egg is permitted. In other words, the answer is simpler than the question. The question tried to say nolad is a more severe type of muktzah. Rav Nachman's answer is it is not more severe. It is treated as any other muktzah. Li'olam b'tar negova salmetis tegadol beyim. We are talking about a chicken that is set aside to lay eggs, and the egg is therefore muktzah. However, the islay muktzah, he who holds of muktzah, which is Rabbi Yehuda, islay nolad, has a prohibition of nolad. Udaleslay muktzah, and he who does not have muktzah, namely Rabbi Shimon, leslay nolad, does not have a problem of nolad. Therefore, Beis Shammai permits the egg, because he follows Rabbi Shimon, and Beis Hillel forbids the egg because he follows Rabbi Yehuda. Okay, so this is the explanation number one of the Mishnah. So again, to summarize the basic halachos here, if the chicken were to be set aside for shechita, for food, the egg would not be muktzah at all, it would just be part of the chicken. The chicken is food, the egg is food. So both Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel would say not muktzah. If the chicken is set aside for laying eggs, however, then the egg is a newly created entity by acquiring a new function. That's the machlokas. Beis Shammai says mutter, because Beis Shammai holds like Rabbi Shimon that there is no rule of muktzah. Again, what does that mean? There's no rule of muktzah. We don't pass like Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon's shita is that even objects which were non-usable when Shabbos begins can be used later. And Rav Nachman says that doesn't only apply to objects in existence that became non-usable, but it even applies to objects that were not in existence, namely Nolad. And Beis Hillel assers, because he holds like Rabbi Yehuda, in other words, according to Rabbi Nachman, Nolad and Muktza, regular Muktza, are treated as exactly the same, and Rabbi Shimon Rav Yehuda would argue about Nolad as well. But now the Gemara is going to say that Rav Nachman himself did not seem to go with that assumption. Umi Amar Rav Nachman Hachi. Did Rav Nachman say Muktza and Nolad walk in tandem? V'atnan. Now again, the only way we can understand Muktza is, and the Gemara gives you many examples. On each example you've got to think about, you know, what is the Muktza problem here. But here is a Mishnah. It's a Mishnah Maseches Shabbos that says the following. They Shamay Omrim Magbihin Me'al HaShulchan Atzamos Uklipin. Alright, here is the problem. And again, this is actually a real halachic issue we have today. When you finish eating, you might wind up with a pile of bones or peels. Peels of eggs, peels of nuts, shells of nuts, inedible peels of fruit. Let's say a banana peel, right? Orange peels might be considered edible. Now the question becomes, this is really what you might call this a reverse muktzah problem. This is actually a reversal of the extinguished candle. The extinguished candle issue involves something that was not usable when Shabbos began, that became usable when the candle went out. So according to Rabbi Shimon, it's not muktzah. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it is muktzah. The peels and bones that materialize after you've had your meal are a reverse muktzah problem. They were usable when Shabbos began. There was your chicken. It now became garbage in the middle of your meal, or as you finished your meal. They are now muktzah. The bones are now muktzah because right now they don't have a use. Now, muktzah, I mentioned, not only not allowed to use, but you're not allowed to even move. So how do you get rid of the bones and the shells on your table? Beis Shammai says, no problem. Again, he seems to say there's no problem of muktzah. Magbien mi'al ha'shulchan, you simply lift up from the table the bones and the shells, meaning Beis Shammai, once again, is not worried about the fact that these are not usable things. Beis Hillel Omrim, Beis Hillel has a problem here. Beis Hillel says, Misalek es hatavla kula, you must lift up the tray, umenara, and shake it off. Again, Beis Hillel is basically saying, the shells and the bones, which are not edible, are muktzah. You're not allowed to move them directly, but the way you dispose of them is you lift up the tray that they're on, and you can empty the tray into the garbage or into the outside. That actually raises a lot of problems too, but you can do it that way, but you cannot directly move the bones. So we seem to have another machlokas, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, about muktzah. Okay? Now, the Amar Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman explained this machlokas by saying, Anu ein lanu, we have no other explanation, Ella, Beis Shammai permits it, because he goes like Rabbi Yehuda. I'm sorry. The other way around. Is he reversing it? What's he doing? I'm sorry. Yeah. Rav Nachman is actually saying we should reverse the opinions. We should reverse the opinions. And it is actually Beis Shammai that is strict. That Beis Shammai goes like Rabbi Yehuda, Ubeis Hillel goes like Rabbi Shimon. Now you see again, the girsa that we have is Beis Shammai seems to say you can handle the muktzah directly. Beis Hillel says you can't. Rav Nachman says you should reverse the opinions. Meaning, what does that mean? Beis Shammai is following Rebbe Yehuda that you cannot handle the muktzah directly. And Beis Hillel follows Rabbi Shimon that you could handle the muktzah directly. In other words, he changes the order. In other words, he had a tradition that the order is reversed. So the Gemara's kasha is simply this. If that's what Rav Nachman said, he's contradicting himself. Because in our Mishnah, he explained Beis Hillel in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda, which is why the egg is forbidden. And in Masechta Shabbos, he explains Beis Hillel according to Rabbi Shimon, which is why you're allowed to handle the bones directly. So what is it? Does Beis Hillel go like Rabbi Shimon? Or does Beis Hillel go like Rabbi Yehuda? Rav Nachman contradicts himself. Right, that's the Gemara's Kasha on Rav Nachman.
But Beis Hillel says
no, well that's what it says, but Rav Nachman says you should reverse the opinions. So it's Beis Shammai that says remove it with the table. In other words, he changes it. So that's the Gemara's Kasha, that according to Rav Nachman, he contradicts himself because he makes Beis Hillel go like Rabbi Shimon. Okay, so that's a Kasha. So let's just read this answer. So Amar Lach Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman would say to you. Now you understand, you know, whenever the one says Amar Lach Rav Nachman, it is not quoting Rav Nachman. Amar Lach is always an imaginary reconstruction. Rav Nachman would say to you if he would be here to answer. In other words, when Rav Nachman is talking, it just says Amar Rav Nachman. Amar Lach Rav Nachman is our reconstruction. Let me just give you the answer outside first, because the answer itself is a very, very intricate answer, because it's based on a lot of proofs. But the essence of the answer is there is a chiluk between Shabbos and Yom Tov. Beis Hillel paskins like Rabbi Shimon on Shabbos, and that's the case of the bones, and he paskins like Rabbi Yehuda on Yom Tov. In other words, he is actually stricter in the laws of muktzah on Yom Tov than he is on Shabbos. And that answers the contradiction, right? Because the case of the bones is Shabbos, and the case of the egg is Yom Tov. And the Gemara is going to prove that by a very intricate proof, by many, many different Mishnayos. But the essence of the idea is that since Yom Tov, people take more for granted. You're allowed to do stuff. So the Chachamim felt it was necessary to be stricter in some respects so people would realize the holiness of Yom Tov. Shabbos, there's less of a need to superimpose additional restrictions because the Torah itself is so strict. So actually what the Gemara is saying is the halacha is like, not the halacha, but at least Rav Nachman is learning that Beis Hillel paskins like Rabbi Shimon on Shabbos. Now, we happen not to paskin like Rav Nachman, because according to the Gemara here, if the candle goes out on Shabbos, you'd be allowed to use the oil. We paskin not that way. We paskin like Rabbi Yehuda and everything. But at least Rav Nachman is adopting this intermediate position. Okay? Okay, maybe we'll stop here. Okay.